This is a story about what many of us would consider exceptional faith coming from something of an unexpected quarter. Do you agree with that? You don't have to raise your hand, but nod of head. I mean, this is pretty unique, exceptional faith, and it's coming from someone that you wouldn't think would have the knowledge or the posture to express it. So, of course, I'm thinking a lot about faith this week. And I was thinking about how hard it is, once you have come to faith in Jesus Christ, to actually step out of that and either remember or think about what it was like not to have faith in Jesus Christ. And so I'm a pastor, and you know, I look at the world around me, and I look beyond the four walls of the church, and I look beyond the community a little bit, and I see things on TV, and I watch things online, and I just encounter news of all different sorts, and people of all different sorts, and I wonder why everyone doesn't just believe in Jesus Christ. I mean, at the very least, it seems stupid at least not to hedge your bets in that direction. I mean, when it comes to your eternal salvation, whether or not you're really bought into the fact that there's an eternity, I mean, just in case there is one, wouldn't you want to do what you needed to do? Wouldn't you want to put your faith in the right place just in case? And yet it must be that a lot of people don't really think about eternity all that much, don't think about things like salvation on one hand or damnation on the other. And so I sit in my position as a believer, as a person of faith, and I kind of just evaluate and judge somewhat and wonder why not everyone has faith. And yet, when I read a story like this, it forces me to ask some questions about the strength, the nature of my own faith. You know, what constitutes a saving faith? Now, in another place, Jesus says that faith the size of a mustard seed is sufficient faith to accomplish great things. Here he talks about kind of levels of faith with regard to the centurion as compared to the people that should have known better, the people that should have had a leg up in terms of coming to faith in a Messiah that should have been expected and waited for and recognized when he came. And so we're going to talk a little bit about faith today, this morning. And I want you to do some introspection this morning. I want you to kind of evaluate your own faith as we talk about the faith expressed by the centurion and how Jesus responds to it, and according to Jesus, what that faith means in terms of implications that are much greater than just the centurion. And so I said that this is a story of exceptional faith that comes from an unexpected quarter. What makes it an unexpected quarter? Well, a centurion was a fixture in Roman society of Jesus' day. A centurion was actually a soldier who was in command of a number of soldiers. How many soldiers do you think that a centurion would command? 100, okay, hence the name centurion. And so this centurion, we read right away in verse 5, This centurion that we read of right away is a man who has power and position in the society of which he's a part. Okay? I mean, this is a guy that when he gives a command, those orders are followed. This is a guy who is in charge of 100 men. He has risen to this position where he is competent and he is trustworthy and he has 100 guys ready to obey his every whim. They trust him that much. This is a person of authority, and he's also a person of means, okay? We see that in verse 6, I believe. And it's not a direct statement about him, but we can discern it from the text that since he has a servant and a household, that not only was he successful and accomplished, but he was a man of means as well. And so I would argue that this centurion is a lot like many of us. It's a lot like many of us in terms of the options that he has, in terms of the power that he has in the world in which he exists. Because look, all of us have any number of choices on any number of things. We are free to make decisions. We are free to work where we want. We are free to do what we want. We are free in any number of ways. And we have power at least over our own lives. We have the means by which to pursue the things that make us happy, to pursue the things that make life worth living. But this centurion encounters a situation. Encounters a situation that for all of his accomplishment, for all of his success, for all of the means at his disposal, he can't do anything to change. He has a servant in his household that has gotten sick. And the centurion can do nothing in his own power to rectify this situation. Now, even this speaks pretty well of the centurion, that he's not only a man of accomplishment, he's not only a man of success and means, he's also a man that is concerned about those who are lower in status than he is. But he finds himself in a situation where he is somewhat helpless. And so he does something that is quite strange, quite unique. This Roman soldier, this man of accomplishment and position and resources, approaches this Jewish rabbi, this person that in the power structure that was evident in the world had really no standing. The centurion goes to humble Jesus and says, I need your help. I need your help. Now, what was the centurion risking when he goes to Jesus? I mean, look. The Jews really hated the Roman power structure. And if anything represented the Roman power structure that was oppressive to Israel, oppressive to God's people, it would have been a centurion. It would have been a soldier. And so the centurion is actually risking almost being laughed off and ridiculed by Jesus, completely ignored. Because why would a Jewish rabbi, one of the have-nots, decide, of course, I'll help you, a centurion, you, one of the reasons why my people are kept down in the world? So the fact that this was not just a Roman, but a Roman of position and power, makes this story that much more unlikely. And so he's in an uncomfortable spot. He's in an uncomfortable spot. He says to Jesus, I need your help. Now, we should understand that the centurion coming to Jesus and asking for help, as we see in some of the subsequent verses, has much bigger implications than just the situation at hand. Has much bigger implications than just the servant being healed at the end of the story. And this is made very clear in verse 10. When Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, I tell you the truth, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. And so here is a microcosm life and death situation for this servant. But we bump it out, and we see that this is a life and death situation for the centurion as well. This is a life and death situation for us that we see in this story in microcosm. And Jesus knows this. And so the Roman centurion coming to him gives him this opportunity to teach not only the centurion, but also his disciples and the people that were following him. Because he goes on in verse 11 and says, I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Now, he's talking about people worldwide coming to him and feasting at a Jewish table with Jewish patriarchs. And so this is a provocative thing to say, but he goes on in an even more provocative way and says, but the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. In other words, they will be thrown out of God's presence. And so Jesus, with this simple request of faith from an unlikely person in the centurion, Jesus sees this as having implications of the two eternal destinies that each person in life is faced with. The one destiny, one characterized by abundance, the other scarcity. One characterized by the light, the other characterized by darkness. One destiny where rejoicing is the order of the day, and the other where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so this situation, this little interaction between Jesus and the centurion has eternal implications, eternal consequences. And isn't it always the case that the inevitability of death shows us unquestionably our need for something? Maybe it doesn't always show us our need for Jesus if we have no knowledge whatsoever, but it shows us our need for something, and that something is Jesus Christ, whether you realize it or not. I said at the beginning, it shocks me that so many people seem to live their lives la-di-dying through without ever considering these two destinies, without ever considering eternity. And because they've never seriously considered eternity, they've never seriously considered Jesus Christ either. Jesus is the only one that holds our eternal destiny in his hands. And so the centurion comes to Jesus with by no means a great foundation of this knowledge or understanding. He comes with at just a bare minimum of the beginning of this understanding that Jesus' authority is not only much different than he has ever seen, but much different in terms of the structure and the scope of it as well. The centurion asks with just a flicker of this knowledge, perhaps we could even call it a hope at this point. And in verse 7, Jesus says to him, "Yes, I will go and heal your servant." And so let's put ourselves in the centurion's shoes for a minute. Jesus doesn't balk at all at the fact that this Roman is approaching him, a Jew. In fact, he doesn't even mention it. Jesus doesn't take a few moments to think it over. He's very decisive. And I want you to notice Jesus' confidence in his authority to act upon this request as well. I mean, this request is nothing to Jesus. I mean, he doesn't sit back and think, how is this going to work out? Am I going to be able to do this? None whatsoever. And I'm sure that this was not lost on the centurion. This guy who knew all about authority, who knew all about the chain of command. And we see that very clearly in verses 8 and 9, where the centurion responds to Jesus' willingness to heal his servant by saying, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, that one, come, and he comes, and say to my servant, do this, and he does it." And so when the centurion looked at Jesus, he recognized that he was in the presence of one whose authority was unlike anything that he had ever seen or imagined. This was divine authority. And so it is interesting, and we have no reason to think that the centurion is just posturing or being polite. He didn't feel worthy to be in Jesus' presence. He realized full well that he had no right or position to ask Jesus to do this thing for him, to give him this time to grant this request. And so the centurion before Jesus is in a position of humility. And he's in a position of gratitude, and he appreciated that Jesus looked on him as a human being, looked on him as though he was worth Jesus' time. So Jesus acknowledges it. Jesus answers the request. And we are left marveling at the centurion's faith. So with no foundation of understanding, just probably rumors about what Jesus had done, the centurion comes to Jesus with just what I would call a beginning measure of faith when it comes to understanding, but a great measure of faith when it came to hope and in realizing his need and in realizing his options. The centurion comes to Jesus, and he really has nothing to do but be confident that Jesus can answer him somehow. And Jesus makes good on that. But not only does Jesus make good on it, he responds to the centurion with astonishment, and this is where we're going to land, and this is where we're going to close. When Jesus heard this, he was astonished, said to those following him, "I tell you the truth, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." Now, I want you to notice that he does use the word great faith, okay? Jesus says, okay, this faith is unique. This is faith that I have not seen before, but I don't want you to think that this is a faith that is exceptional, that this faith is a faith that we read about in the Bible and that there's no way we could attain this kind of faith. I don't want you to see this as an unattainable or unreachable faith. Because Jesus in this statement is not emphasizing the exceptional faith of the centurion. Jesus' astonishment comes from the fact that that's the only person that's expressing it. In other words, Jesus' astonishment is that there's not hundreds and thousands more people who are willing to go to the same lengths and to have the same trust and to have the same faith in Christ that the centurion did. And he says this is going to have eternal consequences. And so he goes on to talk about the two destinies. You have the feast on one hand, feasting with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you have the place of weeping and gnashing of teeth on the other. And so this measure of faith that Jesus sees in the centurion is the faith that he expects in his immediate context from his fellow Jews, but in a broader context, this is the kind of faith that he simply expects from us. And so I'm evaluating my own faith this week. And I think about the 100 different concerns that I have on any given day. And I'm going to tell you something, and I'm not bragging, but I have a pretty good prayer life, okay? I have a pretty good prayer life, and I'm pretty good when a concern comes up in my head or in my life. I am pretty good about laying that at the cross. I am pretty good about bringing that to God, about bringing that to Christ. I mean, I have an ongoing dialogue. If something comes up, I'm going to pray about it. But then here's my tendency. I bring my concern to Jesus. I set it at the foot of the cross. I take a step away. And then I go grab it again, and I go on with my day. How many of you know exactly what I'm talking about? Pray about something. We give it to Jesus. We step away. We go right back, and we pick it up, and we go on with our day. And then we fret. We fret about unanswered prayers, and we fret that our situations aren't getting any better, and we fret about relationships that just kind of stay broken, okay? The lesson that I think we need to learn from the centurion, and I'm going to assume that we all have faith. The lesson that we need to learn from the centurion is that his faith allowed him to present a concern to Jesus, to in essence lay the concern for his servant at Jesus' feet, and then say, "Jesus, I know you got this," and walk away. See, that's what's amazing to me. That's the example that I think that we see in this story. That's what has traction in our own lives. That's not to say that if you give over every concern, that all concerns go away. But it is to say, once you've given a concern to Jesus, you step back and you walk away from it and you navigate life the best that you can and you be obedient and you do the things that you need to do, knowing that Jesus has it. And that creates a life without regret. That creates a life where you don't have to constantly ask yourself, did I do enough? Or did I have strong enough faith? Or, did I not do this right or that right? Or did I say this wrong thing? That lifts all of that burden off of you. And you can go through life day by day dealing with the concerns that come your way by passing them on to Jesus and moving on unencumbered, joyful, grateful. And what does our text say? That is the path, that is the way through Jesus Christ to an eternity of bliss and joy in the presence of our Heavenly Father. Let's pray.